Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Boston Globe will survive for now. Boston.com reports the Globe struck a deal with its largest union to keep the presses rolling and satisfy the owner, the New York Times Company, which had threatened to shut down the paper if the unions didn't agree to huge cuts. But will the Globe, or journalism as we know it, continue to survive as other large dailies fold or convert to online editions? Today we want to take a look at the future of journalism with some aspiring journalists. Joining us from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, is Sarah Gregory, a junior and managing editor of the school newspaper, The Daily Tar Heel. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
We have Joel Stonington as well. He's finishing up his master's at Columbia Journalism School in New York. He previously worked at the Aspen Times. Joel, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also in New York, Brian Boyer, a recent grad of Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. The school offered him a scholarship as part of a program to train software designers as journalists. Brian's now an intern at ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative news website based in New York City. Brian, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And let's start with you, because you told us that you think J schools in general are behind the curve on teaching students about the new media. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of things being taught in J schools right now as sort of technical things like Flash and HTML.
Well, I'm going to hold you up right there because you give us a little whiff of some of the conversations that are going on at schools. You know, you mentioned this software. A lot of people, when they think they're going to hear a conversation about journalism, they're thinking how to learn how to ask questions, who, what, where, when. You're talking about technology. And is that one of the conversations or debates that's going on in campuses?
Well, absolutely. We're at a point now in journalism where people are being taught how to be the new publishers. And to be the new publishers online, you have to know how to build printing presses. Whereas in radio and video, the tools have gotten so far that you can assemble a pretty quick video pretty easily on your computer or put together a radio program or just type things on a word processor. But when it comes to presenting information online, there's still a lot to be learned. And the tools aren't quite there where it's you can just click, 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 and you've got a website to act journalistically online.
I love that analogy. I mean, you're saying you literally have to learn how to build the new printing press, which is the Internet. And I just want to bring Joel Stonington in for a second from Columbia, because, Joel, there was a report in the New York Times called J Schools Play Catch-Up. And it describes a tension between old and new media. Now, there's always been a tension. You know, print reporters didn't like, you know, spiffed up TV reporters. A tension between teaching theory that, you know, we were just talking about, the who, what, where, when, why, and teaching skills that Brian's talking about. How did you feel that on the Columbia campus?
One way that we felt it was that we had Ken Lehrer come and do a number of sessions at the journalism school. He is the co-founder of Huffington Post, and he taught a business entrepreneurship class. A lot of people were looking to him for answers. How do you make money online? How does a website become successful? What's the future of journalism? How is journalism going to get paid for?
And we understand he also pretty much tore into old media. What? How?
I think that to some degree it's in his best interest to tear into old media because they are one of the new aggregators. They take content from everywhere else and they put it on their own site. Everyone is trying to get into the aggregation business. Just a few weeks ago, the New York Times published a story and posted some links below the story. And one of the links was a Huffington Post link that had linked to the New York Times story,
right,
if that makes any sense.
No, it does. It's like you're caught in an echo chamber.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop to a certain extent. And what people were asking him at the lecture was, how are you going to pay for reporting? And as far as I can tell, no one has answered that question.
Well, and Sarah, I'm just wondering there at UNC, again, you're at the school newspaper. Is there concern even on the part of students, or are you hearing it from professors? It's fine to learn how to be this new publisher, to learn how to aggregate, but you got to have something to aggregate. You know, is there a sense of, wait a second, don't stop teaching us how to go out on the street and be a reporter and get the information that you then will aggregate?
In general, I don't think that there's this pressing, you know, don't stop teaching us the fundamentals of journalism, because I feel that's what a lot of the core classes are teaching. They're not teaching how to be your own publisher.
So you're saying it's actually, you're the opposite problem there. You feel you're not getting enough of the new media.
There are a few classes that are teaching online journalism and how to be the new publisher online. But there's three people in my class. The professor can't get more people to take the class.
Do you think they should?
I think they should. I think that there's a fear of the unknown. Student journalists, I think, in general, are very wedded to the way things have been done, more than you would think that they would be. We've grown up in an environment where we are using technology all day long. We're on Facebook, we're on MySpace, we're on Twitter, we're talking to our friends online, but we haven't been taught yet how to use that for journalism.
Well, and Joel Stonington over at Columbia, you are interviewing for jobs and finding out that people at newspapers want to know if you have that skill.
Yeah, we had a career fair a few weeks ago, and the Bergen Record, they had one position open for a municipalities reporter. And the first question that the editor asked me was if I knew how to shoot and edit video.
Yeah. Well, and thankfully, you did. You took some of those courses. But Joel, are you worried that this push for new media for survival will mean less of an accent on what you write?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the new media students at Columbia took essentially the same classes that the print students did, and they had just had more training with new media skills. But I think that for many of the new media students, there has been necessarily less of a focus on reporting because they just haven't been able to spend the same amount of time on reporting. They haven't been able to spend the same amount of time on writing.
Right.
So those things suffer.
Well, and Brian, what do you think about that? You were a software designer who went to Medill School of Journalism to train as a journalist. Some serious hardcore journalists are looking at you, you know, saying, wait a second, is this a fox in the hen house? You know, are you going to have the same respect for how the sentence is crafted or how the question's asked as how it is presented?
Learning the essentials and sort of the belief system of journalism is very, very important. And learning to write is very helpful because it's you're learning storytelling, which is part of the craft. But there's a disconnect when I hear that, you know, young journalists going out interviewing for jobs are being asked if they have flash skills. This is a problem. Those jobs are saying, do you have flash skills? And so the J schools are responding by teaching things like flash and HTML. And these are things that don't need to be taught to journalists. Journalism students need to be learning a different kind of new media skill. They need to be learning new media savvy. They need to learn why the web is different and why stories are told differently on the web and what shapes these stories can take. They need to understand why Twitter is important, what's interesting about Flickr, what's the deal with Dig. They need to get all of these things. And they don't need to learn to code. I apologize, I'm a coder, so I hope I'm not sounding too self-important here. But programming is very hard. Many people spend many years learning to be a programmer, and it's not something you can just pick up in a quarter at a master's program at a J school.
But it's so funny you say that because this sort of respect that you have for your expertise as a coder is exactly what some journalists are saying about the new media. It sounds like there's tension here.
Absolutely. And then even if, let's just say, people come out of J school being brilliant videographers, excellent audio technicians, and kick-ass coders, there's still this disconnect in new media of the sort of business model. There's this other huge problem. We're talking about saving journalism for the future so our democracy can be preserved. We still haven't solved this.
Yeah. And Sarah, I'm pulling you back in here because some journalism schools are being asked to teach future journalists entrepreneurship so that they can create a job for themselves. But I'm wondering how you feel about that, you know, being told, hey, there's a whole frontier out there. You don't have a job, but, we'll help you create one. Is that exciting or disappointing?
I think it's exciting. There's an opportunity to create something that, you know, isn't there right now. It's also incredibly daunting because you want to do journalism, but you want a way to do it. And right now, it's just not clear what that way is going to be.
Right. But Brian, again, a software designer turned new media journalist, you've told us you think this is the most exciting time to be in journalism. What? Why?
I'm absolutely geeked to be here. I think that the house is burning down, yes, but this is a moment of rebirth. This is a time when we can create something totally new. I don't think that journalism is going away. I think newspapers will probably mostly go away. There's an opportunity for some of us to rebuild this institution in totally new fashions.
And how do you envision it?
It could take many forms. I think just a couple weeks ago, PolitiFact, a fantastic online resource, just won a Pulitzer. PolitiFact is an intersection of software and journalism, right, where people have been doing research following promises made by politicians and then ranking them and showing them in little meters and things like that. That's just sort of one small example of what you can do differently.
Right. In fact, Sarah Gregory there at UNC Chapel Hill, describe every journalism student.
We're attached to our iPhones, to our BlackBerries. We are looking at Twitter. We are constantly checking Facebook. we're also, you know, still doing the traditional out in the field, you know, heading to the Pit, which is our center of campus, and, you know, talking with students there and finding out about what's going on. I generally, if I send an email to someone, get a response in, you know, half an hour tops, because everyone is so connected.
Yes, but do I hear you clicking a pen?
Yes.
Good. You have a pen still.
I have a pen and a reporter's notebook, and I've got Twitter pulled up on my phone right now.
Yeah. So. And do you pick up a pen? Do you read newspapers?
I do. I mean, I read the Daily Tar Heel every day. I grab our local paper, the Raleigh News and Observer, and I skim through that each day, and I occasionally grab New York Times.
And if those newspapers go away, what are you doing?
I mean, I think the core of journalism doesn't change. Journalism is about telling a story, about exposing wrongs, and that doesn't change. There's still a value for that. There's still a value for news. I think that what will change is just the medium, and if that medium isn't newspapers, then, you know, I'm really excited about working for an online paper or working for something like Huffington Post. Any way that I could continue telling a story.
Joel Stonington at Columbia, what is the mood on campus as you're about to graduate?
The mood on campus is it's not particularly upbeat. There are very few students who have jobs. By very few, I mean, you know, less than a dozen. There are a number of students who've gone to internships, but everyone knows the state of internships are not the best right now. The Associated Press didn't hire any of their interns last year, so it's not upbeat.
Well, and we see newspapers closing around us and, you know, the whole media landscape shrinking. Pretty much the common thinking now is that newspapers made a huge mistake by offering their content for free. And as a result, one of the most popular ideas is to move towards a sort of a micropayment system. Readers might pay 10 or 15 cents for a story. Brian, do you think ultimately people of your generation, 15 to 35, who expect to get everything for free online are going to have to change that thinking?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so at all. I don't believe models proposed like micropayments are necessarily the future of news. If it's available for free from one source, that model won't work. So if it's on the AP Wire via Yahoo News, then I don't really need to get it from the Detroit Free Press. I feel like advertisement-related models potentially are going to be strong, or there's a way of funding things described by the editor of Wire magazine, Chris Anderson, called freemium services, where you get a good deal for free and then the power users pay. So, for instance, on a website like Flickr, where you have a large number of users, a very, very tiny number of them pay for the power user services. And the rest of us get to use Flickr for free because they're willing to pay.
Well, that's Brian Boyer, a recent graduate of Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and someone who we all might be working for in the future. Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We also spoke with Sarah Gregory, a junior at UNC Chapel Hill. Sarah, we look forward to seeing your reporting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Joel Stonington, soon to be graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism. Joel, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And by the way, for those of you scratching your heads and saying, Flickr, flash skills, we can say that flash skills are the ability to edit on your computer. Just ahead, a longtime flu researcher says it's way too early to relax about swine flu. That's after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and U.S. health officials told Congress today they've successfully identified the genetic characteristics of the swine flu virus and that they're in a good position to begin producing vaccines as needed. Well, officials have also revised earlier guidelines. They're no longer recommending schools be shut down because of swine flu, just that people who are sick stay home. Yesterday, Texas reported its second flu-related death and the first death of a U.S. citizen, a 33-year-old school teacher who had recently given birth. Officials said she had other health problems. And in Mexico, life is slowly returning to normal as new cases have begun to ebb, leaving many new questions. So let's ask them of Dr. Robert Webster of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. He's been working on the flu for 50 years. And Dr. Webster, first of all, how serious is this virus? We're all braced, you know, because of the early alarms. But now many Americans are feeling, you know, what happened?
I think that we still have to continue to handle this virus very carefully, or consider it very carefully. We're not out of the woods by any means. This virus is still going to continue to evolve. It's just a pup, if you like, in terms of its potential evolution.
Just a pup, just starting. And we remember that the awful pandemic of 1918 also had sort of a false start where people were dismissing it and then it came back with a vengeance.
That's right. We remember the mild wave of the spring of that year. And so that's at the back of our minds. So we must treat this and we must get vaccines and strategies into place for the fall.
When the question is raised, did sounding the alarm stop something worse or was it a false alarm? You say sounding the alarm stopped something worse.
I think sounding the alarm is what we have to do so that the various switches can be turned on in pandemic preparedness and for the scientific community to get the vaccines that are going to be necessary put in place.
And by the way, do you know where we are on the development of a vaccine? Early on, we were told it would be about 2 months.
That's, I think, is optimistic. The real world situation is it usually takes 6 months to get a vaccine available. We are all busting our butts to do this.
And what's the difficulty?
Well, first you have to make a virus that will grow sufficiently in whatever culture system that you're going to use. You have to be sure that the vaccine strain that you've made is safe to work with those making the vaccine, and that the vaccine is safe to put into people. It takes time to make the seed stock, test the seed stock, get that seed stock to the manufacturers, and it takes time. You're starting to make a vaccine from zero level, and it's really an enormous achievement to get this done even in 6 months.
Well, and do scientists know what they're making the vaccine for yet? Because
Yes, we know exactly.
You do.
The Centers for Disease Control have provided the virus strains to do this work immediately.
Well, then help us understand that. The names have changed. This is now, in many cases, the flu formerly known as swine. Health officials are now referring to it as the H1N1. So tell us more about what exactly it is we're talking about.
Well, briefly, if we go back to 1918 and the Spanish flu pandemic, that virus spread and caused catastrophic outbreak in humans and also affected pigs, and is the precursor of the virus that stayed in the pig population known as classical swine flu from 1918 to 1998. And by 1998, it was a very wimpy virus in pigs, but in 1998, that virus got together with a human virus and a virus, influenza virus from wild birds in the United States, and it became what we call a triple reassortant. There are 8 gene segments in the virus, and some of the segments came from humans, some from pigs, and some from wild birds. Mm-hmm. And the gene segments from wild birds made the virus much more transmissible.
Again, what's the fear? Because except for the terribly tragic deaths here in the U.S., people don't seem to be getting very sick. So even if it's spread, what is the big fear?
I return to my statement, this virus is a pup in humans. And it's probably changing and acquiring ability to spread even better.
And become more virulent? In other words, spread further but also make people sicker?
Well, that's what nature will tell. We don't know whether it will make people sicker or become wimpy.
We've been reading words like wimpy, and another word that's used in scientific papers is that these viruses can fizzle out, and we just don't know yet which way it's going to go. But do you know why it seems to have affected so many young people? Normally when we fear flu, it's in the elderly, and so far we're not hearing of those cases. Why is that, do you think?
I think we are now starting to understand that these people are at their peak of performance in their lives, if you like, and they turn on the cytokine responses, innate responses, and the body tends to overreact to the attacking agent.
We've heard this. It's sort of like they're so strong that they get something called a cytokine storm to fight the bug, and they overwhelm their own systems.
That's right. The young people tend to overreact to the virus and do themselves damage.
Well, if someone has had the flu, let's say all those kids in Queens, Are they then immune to it? Because we understand one of the other fears is that we don't have an immunity to it, a natural immunity to it.
Once you've had this particular H1N1 virus, mm-hmm. once you've had it, you will have an immunity to it.
Right.
But so far, we don't know at the moment whether the current seasonal vaccine provides any protection worth speaking of against this one.
That's Dr. Webster of St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. He's worked on the flu for 50 years. And, Doctor, it sounds as if you're saying it is nowhere near time to relax on this issue.
I would agree entirely. Let's be very vigilant, let's wash our hands, and don't sneeze on people, and be careful.
Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead today, Elizabeth Edwards tells her story in a new book. How is Washington reacting, and can John Edwards be redeemed as a political figure? That's after the news, here and now. Car bombs killed at least 17 people and wounded dozens more in Baghdad today. For the seriously wounded, getting care in Iraq is difficult because there's a shortage of equipment and experienced doctors. But the care, at least for some, is available in nearby Jordan, where a team of Iraqi surgeons is working in a special clinic. The clinic's operated on more than 600 Iraqis in the last 2 years. Another 100 are still on a waiting list in Iraq. The BBC's Natalia Antalava visited the clinic and prepared this report.
Hussein is 7 years old. Dressed in a red tracksuit, he sits up on his hospital bed, his eyes covered with bandages. As he speaks, his lips move slowly because his skin, badly scarred and dark brown from severe burns, cannot stretch. When he was a baby, his mother explains, a car bomb exploded near their house in Baghdad.
His grandmother was taking him across the street when it happened. She burned and died. We found him badly burnt.
Hussein's mother thought he would be disfigured for life. Then, a few months ago, she heard about this free clinic in Jordan that could restore Hussein's skin. But on the operating table, doctors discovered that something else was badly wrong.
The child, during anesthesia, he couldn't close his eyes, both eyes. It is very dangerous in the future.
This Iraqi doctor is not surprised that during many previous operations back in Iraq, no one ever noticed that Hussein could not shut his eyes.
In Iraq is not very good medical care. They only save their lives. The other things they consider like...
It's luxury.
Yeah, luxury.
Since 2006, a team of Iraqi surgeons here in Amman has been trying to complete the work started by their colleagues in Iraq. Funded by Médecins Sans Frontières, they have already operated on more than 600 patients. Dr. Aningan Tiren heads the program.
Some of them are not able to have any kind of life because they're so handicapped that they cannot anymore be part of the society. We do save their lives indirectly because they have many reasons to die slowly if they're not treated.
I'm inside an operating room where a team of doctors are performing a surgery on a young Iraqi man. It's facial reconstruction. So his face is cut open and so is his hip. So they're actually going to take bone from his hip and use it to reconstruct his face.
The procedure lasts for 6 hours. The head surgeon says he could never do this in Iraq.
If you want to do a surgery, which is 6 hour surgery or 7 hour surgeries, you will finish at 4 or 5. Then you will need an extra 2 hours to go back home, which is not feasible because it will be night and it will be difficult for the staff, for the doctors to go back. It's a matter of the security in general, in which you cannot go in the streets.
But security is an issue even here. The head surgeon cannot give his name. In Iraq, the insurgency is still strong, and doing even this kind of work under a Western umbrella could put his relatives there in danger. But for his colleagues back home, he says, it's much more difficult.
The real heroes are not us. The real heroes are those doctors who are working in Iraq in these difficult conditions.
The clinic relies on a network of doctors in Iraqi hospitals who refer cases to Amman. They all work undercover, keeping their identity anonymous. 100 people are currently waiting for their turn to come here.
and back in his hospital room, Hussein and three other children are recovering. The girls are too ill to speak, but Hussein chats away. I want to be a doctor, he tells me, so that I can make a lot of money and buy chickens and fruit anytime I want. Hussein is waiting for more surgery, but eventually his bandages will come off and he will be sent home. But Iraq is still violent and dangerous, and his hospital bed here won't stay empty for long.
The BBC's Natalia Antalava in Amman, Jordan. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, Bernie Madoff's right-hand man is reportedly ready to talk about how many people were involved in the $50 billion Ponzi scheme. He is reportedly going to name names. We'll have that for you tomorrow. And we'll be back with Washington's reaction to the Edwards in half a minute, Here and Now. There's been no shortage of public political pain in recent years. A rising star attorney general in New York brought down by a call girl. The governor of New Jersey comes out to the country and his wife. A senator is found in a delicate situation in a men's room. There was, of course, the Clintons. And now there's the Edwards. Back in the 90s, John and Elizabeth Edwards lost a son in a car accident. She has terminal cancer. But now Elizabeth Edwards is revealing that her husband John, fresh from announcing his presidential campaign in 2006, told her he had what he said was a one-night stand with a video producer he hired to document his run. Elizabeth Edwards soon learned it was much more than a one-night stand. And now she's telling her story this week in a new book and interview with Oprah.
The other woman has a baby.
That's what I understand.
And there is great speculation that your husband, John Edwards, is the father of that baby.
Right. That's what I understand. I've seen a picture of the baby. I have no idea. It doesn't look like my children, but I don't have any idea.
Elizabeth Edwards doesn't name the other woman in her book or in the interview, but the video producer, Rael Hunter, is also the subject of a federal investigation. John Edwards acknowledged this past weekend that he is cooperating with the authorities, looking into whether he made illegal payments to Hunter through his political action committee. What is Washington making of all of this? Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, how is Washington viewing this?
With a touch of unreality surrounding all of it, because the revelations have been fast and furious with the book coming out and now news of a federal investigation into these possible payments to Ms. Hunter. There's a lot of folks who work for John Edwards and invested a lot of time and energy in John Edwards who are downright angry over the whole affair and chagrined to see it out there again. It's something that's on their resume forever and on their public profile forever, and they'd certainly like to erase it. We've heard Elizabeth Edwards and even Joe Trippi, the former campaign advisor, say he shouldn't have run in the first place, given everything that came out. But, of course, they were singing a much different tune when the campaign was going on.
Well, and the other questions are who knew what when. But you mentioned whether or not he should have run. And Elizabeth Edwards says in the book and in the Oprah interview that she actually begged him not to run after he told her of what, you know, he then said was a one-night stand. This was shortly after he announced. And he told her, that he felt that they were sort of trapped into running because if they didn't run, then the affair might be exposed because people would ask why.
That's right. And this is just so much different than anything that Elizabeth Edwards had said publicly before on the subject of whether he should run. You'll recall her recurrence of cancer that came out shortly after he had entered the race for 2008 for the Democratic nomination. And at the time, she talked about how supportive she was, how important it was for him to run. It wasn't like she was shying away. She's always had such a huge public profile, more than most political spouses. She's been associated with her husband and what he tried to do. So this going back and now filling in some of the gaps and maybe rewriting some of the history just adds to the sense of turmoil around all of this.
Well, and we are hearing also how it all started. Here's another clip from Oprah in which Elizabeth Edwards describes how her husband told her he met videographer Rael Hunter.
What John had said is this woman had spotted him in the hotel in which he was staying. He was meeting with someone in the restaurant bar area, and she had verified with someone who John worked with that it was John, and then John had gone to dinner. I didn't speak to her then, but he'd gone to dinner at a nearby restaurant, and then he had walked back to the hotel, and when he walked back, she was standing in front of the hotel and said to him, you are so hot, I can't deliver it, because I don't know how you deliver such a line as that, but you are so hot.
Well, Elizabeth Edwards writes that those words led to what Edwards told her was a terrible decision. But just staying with what we just heard there, Elizabeth Edwards is blaming the other woman. She calls her a predator. She seems to be much more forgiving of her husband. She writes how John Edwards looks at her now, even with her chemo hair and, you know, dark circles under her eyes, as if she's the most beautiful woman in the world. Is there possibly redemption here for John Edwards in that Elizabeth Edwards is, at least for the most part, standing by him?
I can see private redemption, but public redemption is very hard to envision. You never say never in politics, but it's hard to imagine him having any kind of a political future, given not just the revelations of an extramarital affair, but the duplicity that was involved in all of it, and the way that his campaign was built on a message of truthfulness and hope and trust. All of that was shattered, and it's hard to imagine these people in Washington and beyond who invested hopes and aspirations in him wanting to go through that again,
well,
no matter what comes out.
You mentioned the word hope. I can only think of the man from Hope, and you know what the Clintons managed to turn around. And you know, there are a lot of Americans who feel protective of couples like this who've been, you know, made terrible mistakes perhaps, but are in the public eye, and you know, feel that the spotlight is just too bright, and you know, forgive them.
Look, the Clintons are the model for that kind of public redemption for any politician who has an ethical or moral lapse. People have moved beyond that in large part. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if Bill Clinton could run again today. But I do think, and it's impossible to know. I mean, you know, 3, 4, 5 election cycles from now, John Edwards could still be young enough to run for president. He's only 55 now. So it's you can foresee something potentially happening. It's hard to imagine, right, given the totality of the circumstances.
Well, and how are different sides of the political spectrum treating this? You know, we don't feel we're hearing vilifying from the right, you know, painting the Democrats as a party with loose morals. Maybe we're not listening, but we don't feel we're hearing that. And we don't feel we're hearing much from the left. Is everybody just trying to ignore it?
Well, look, he doesn't hold public position right now. I think from the Republican perspective, they privately relish in something like this, but this is still the party of David Vitter and Larry Craig and Mark Foley, and it isn't a debate that either party really wants to get into when it comes to issues of extramarital affairs, when it comes to issues of personal infidelities. From the Democratic perspective, John Edwards obviously is not part of the Obama administration, has no formal role advising. I don't think we'll ever see the two of them, the president greeting John Edwards at the White House or anywhere else. So this is being viewed, I think, as something of a sideshow from both parties' perspectives, not something that they want to deal with, unless, again, you worked for him at one time, and then there's no doing away with it.
Or were recipients of a lot of the charity that came his way because he was such a poster child for the poor.
That's right, and that work even continues to this day. And you know, there's just such disappointment out there, and I think this goes to the charities as well, that maybe this act of public redemption attempted by Elizabeth Edwards goes toward trying to make sure that they have a future in that world, being part of the realm of public debate and discussion, not to be pariahs.
What about the money? Federal authorities investigating John Edwards' finances. Reportedly, he paid Hunter $114,000 for the video she made. Remind us the questions surrounding the money.
Well, the issue is whether there was any use of campaign dollars for personal use. That's illegal. That's illegal under federal election law. And I think more troubling from John Edwards' perspective is that this is going to open the door on a whole range of financial entanglements that he's had through private foundations and charities, as well as through the campaign. We know, for example, that his former finance chairman, now the late Fred Barron, funded out of his own pocket Rail Hunter, knowing that this was going on, and is sort of legal hush money is what it looked like to a lot of observers. If there was some use of foundation money or campaign funds, then we're talking about legal problems that are, you know, a lot more serious than any tabloid accusation.
Well, and you mentioned the legal costs that might be incurred. Apparently, the Edwards lost a lot of money in a hedge fund. What is he doing now?
He's been given some speeches, and sometimes quite controversially getting figures well into the tens of thousands to speak and answer questions on that circuit. Mostly, I think he's staying out of public view. The work that he's doing still on the Poverty Center and some of the foundation work is going on pretty quietly.
Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Writer Chuck Palahniuk has a fanatical following and a flair for tough topics. Fight Club, men fighting for pleasure. Snuff, an aging porn star sets out to have sex with 600 men in one day. People have reportedly fainted at Chuck Palahniuk readings. His latest book, Pygmy, is written in the voice of a 13-year-old who's been indoctrinated in an unnamed country to hate the U.S. He and fellow terrorists pose as foreign exchange students in a Midwestern town, aiming to carry out a cataclysmic attack. The book evokes 9/11 and Pulp Fiction. It contains eye gouging and a violent rape. It's funny, humane, and horrifying. And author Chuck Palahniuk joins us in the studio.
And it's a love story.
I was going to ask, because you, with all that I just said, you have cast yourself as a romantic.
Every single one of my books are about people who are sort of fossilized in their isolation. And they are finally able to shatter that and unite with one other person by the end of each book, including Pygmy.
Right, and we're not going to give away how he does that, but you have really encased him because even his way of communicating is often unintelligible. He has this, how would you describe his language?
Pygmy doesn't know the word the. He doesn't know the conjunction and. He doesn't know the word day, so he always says today or next today for tomorrow or last today for yesterday.
It's a stilted English, which you might expect from an immigrant, which he is, but it's also part the automaton that his home totalitarian state has created. Let's hear a little. This is as Pygmy describes his first visit to what we come to find out is Walmart. And he sees a maze of competing products, and as the listeners are going to hear, it's presided over by the elderly Walmart greeter, Doris.
Area divided into walls constructed from objects, all tinted color so grab eye, all object printed, love me, look me, millions speaking objects begging, crown American's consumer with power of king to rescue, choose, and give home, or abandon here for expire. Word label blow sharp into ear, loud into eye, pander, hand to take, dying objects all here, useful life winding down in clock ticks, dying objects, dying buyer, dying slave woman Doris. Desperate, how sad.
Yeah. What are you using him for? What's the America that he's seeing?
In a way, the pidgin English, the sort of George Orwell 1984 fascist totalitarian propaganda speak, is a way of reinventing very ordinary everyday things so that we see a megachurch or a Walmart in a fresh, new, unique way, the way an outsider would see it.
Well, and the book flap says that this is a double satire because you also present Americans as xenophobic. But then through Pygmy, you point out, well, maybe they're right to be suspicious of other countries like the one that he comes from. And where is that? Can we guess North Korea?
You know, some of the operatives that he is shipped over with have Eastern European names like Tonic and Pavel and Metro. I actually had a great uncle who came through Ellis Island from the Ukraine named Metro Polonek. What a great name. Other ones have African continent names and other ones have Asian names. So I really wanted to be a kind of completely unspecified totalitarian place they come from.
Well, and we start to learn how he was taught there, and it's horrendous abuse.
It's horrendous abuse, but if it's all you ever know, then it can be depicted without any kind of sentimentality or any kind of emotional baggage to it. And I think that's really important because so many of us, we don't think of our childhood as being tragic or awful. We just think of it as the only childhood we knew.
Right. Well, we, of course, want to ask a little bit about you, Chuck Palahniuk, and how your background might be somehow making its way into this story in whatever way possible. Now, your devoted fans know that you've had violent incidents in your background. Your paternal grandfather killed his wife, some of their children, and then himself. Your father obviously escaped. But then he and his then-girlfriend were killed, you're nodding yes, by her ex-boyfriend. That's a lot of violence in one family background. And I mean, is it just seems pretty facile, but is that part of why you look at it so closely in your books?
It could be, and also the fact, you know, maybe a reason why I don't tend to present very dramatic things in a very dramatic way. I tend to present very dramatic, heavy things, but in a way that takes them sort of doesn't buy into the drama of them, allows some sort of wiggle room for absurd humor. And I hope he will forgive me. When we were going through my father's home after he was murdered, my siblings and I in the cushions of his couch and in the seat of his car and in all these places. We kept on finding half-filled prescription bottles of Viagra. And we would be alternately weeping and then laughing our heads off because it kind of proved that this new relationship in his life was enormously fun and passionate and exciting for him. And I think in a way it might be an Eastern European trait to treat tragedy as this sort of Gogol short story, as this sort of source of dark, absurdist humor.
Yeah.
So it might be genetic.
Well, you must know that you're going to bring the listener to a lot of different places. We mentioned 9/11. You know, this must be what those terrorists were thinking. Columbine, because there's a school shooting. Do you ever think, oh, I better back off this? There's a scab I don't want people to have to pick.
I think we can disempower things much more effectively by acknowledging them and denying the drama of them than we can by completely denying that they're even in the room. These things are going to happen whether or not we acknowledge that they happen. And maybe the most effective thing we can do is to find some way to ultimately laugh at them over enough time.
Yeah. Many of your readers are guys, Fight Club, and this they'll love. There's a lot of martial arts. I'm looking at the pictures of Pygmy doing the flying giant stork death kick. Is there ever a thought of, well, you know, maybe you'll get a guy who's reading it and thinking, yeah, blow this up. And at the end, he also has a little bit of redemption, as Pygmy does.
Exactly. And in a way, you're kind of giving people a cathartic or a surrogate experience so that they can maybe have the fantasy and then move beyond it.
Yeah. What about the fighting, though? Do you do martial arts or are you...
You know, my father was a boxer, and I've since taken martial arts classes. I love them. There is nothing more fun and more exhausting than sparring.
Well, I'm thinking, too, and then this is keeping a little bit of your father, too.
Right, and they're the kind of books that Dad would really love.
Yeah. Chuck, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Chuck Palahniuk's latest book is Pygmy. To hear a little more from Chuck, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.